From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. It's been 25 years since the Velvet Underground broke up. Although they never made the charts in the 60s, they're now considered one of the most daring and important bands in rock history. On today's Fresh Air, rock historian Ed Ward reviews their new box set retrospective. Then we'll talk with actress Mary Woronoff. She dropped out of college to tour with the Velvets, doing the whip dance, and to appear in Andy Warhol's movie Chelsea Girls. She's written a memoir about that period of her life. Also today, rating the morals of movies, we talk with Henry Herks, director of the U.S. Catholic Conference's Film and Broadcasting Office. Their new telephone hotline offers reviews of the latest films. We'll give it a call. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. Negotiators for the Clinton administration and Congress are scheduled to resume budget talks at this hour as the White House presents a new plan for eliminating the federal deficit in 7 years. UPI's Bill Small reports conservative Democrats are welcoming the president's proposal.
The conservative House Democrats known as Blue Dogs called Mr. Clinton's 7-year balanced budget plan very good news and a positive step in the right direction, but indicated Mr. Clinton needs to take more such steps toward their budget proposals, including the one barring any tax cut, until the budget is balanced. Minnesota's Cullen Peterson.
Right now, we're sticking with that plan. Although we are realists, the president has a tax cut on the table, the Republicans have a tax cut on the table, there's probably going to be some kind of a tax cut.
The group says any tax cut should also contain an enforcement provision to make sure that the budget will still be balanced, even if economic assumptions turn out worse or better than expected. Bill Small at the White House.
The U.S. is stepping up pressure on Bosnia's Muslim-led government to be sure that Iranian and Afghan Muslim fighters leave the country and do not pose a threat to American peacekeeping troops to be stationed there. Many of the Muslims are in what will be the American sector around Tuzla in northeastern Bosnia. State Department spokesman Nicholas Burns says the U.S. wants the Iranian and Afghan soldiers out of that area. A military court in Rome has delayed a decision on whether to prosecute a former SS captain on war crimes charges. Regina Sansaloni reports from Rome.
The ex-Nazi officer Eric Kripke said nothing after emerging from the 4-hour hearing and remained impassive as relatives of some of the victims waiting outside the courtroom called him an assassin. The 82-year-old Kripke is accused of carrying out the massacre of 335 Italian civilians in the Ardeatine Caves near Rome in 1944. The killings were in reprisal for the deaths of 32 German soldiers in Rome by a partisan ambush. Kripke has admitted his role in the murders, but said he was only acting under orders. The judge presiding over the preliminary hearing suspended proceedings after a request was made by the families of more than 50 of the victims to attach a civil lawsuit to the case. A decision by Italy's constitutional court on whether to allow the civil suit may take up to 2 months. For National Public Radio, this is Regina Sansaloni in Rome.
The percentage of homeowners behind on their mortgage payments rose to nearly 4.25% in the last quarter. That's the highest level in more than 2 years. The president of the Mortgage Bankers Association says one reason is the recent influx of first-time buyers who have no equity built up and are especially vulnerable to financial emergencies. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down about 44 points at 5,155. In the over-the-counter market, the NASDAQ Composite is down 9. This is NPR News. House Majority Leader Dick Armey says an outside counsel investigation of Speaker Newt Gingrich is a waste of time. The House Ethics Panel says it will name a counsel to investigate a single allegation involving Gingrich's college course. Gingrich says he's certain he'll be vindicated by any investigation. Delta Airlines and its pilots have reached a tentative agreement on two issues that are seen as necessary for the airline to begin no-frills service. From Peach State Radio in Atlanta, Bruce Dorton reports.
Delta wants a short-haul service with a fleet of Boeing 737s to be flown by pilots with lower pay and work rules designed to drive down costs. Both sides have said that an accord on the new low-cost service would be the centerpiece of a new contract. Union spokeswoman Jane Langley says the agreement is part of the overall contract negotiations, which also involve issues such as retirement, medical benefits, pay, a seat for pilots on the company's board, and shares of Delta stock. Delta wants $340 million in concessions from pilots to cut expenses. Langley and Delta spokesman Neil Monroe say that even if the executive committees endorse the tentative agreement, it will not be binding until after other issues are resolved. Both sides have been in talks assisted by a federal mediator since July. For National Public Radio, I'm Bruce Dorton in Atlanta.
Rwanda has agreed to a 3-month extension of the expiring United Nations mandate in the country on the condition that peacekeeping troops leave. The government wants them replaced by a non-military contingent to help with the repatriation of Rwandan refugees. Israeli Prime Minister Shimon Peres arrived in Egypt today for talks with President Mubarak before he heads to the U.S. this weekend. An Israeli newspaper reports that slain Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin would not likely have survived his shooting even if he had been wearing a bulletproof vest. The opinion was attributed to a ballistics expert who cited the type of bullet used and the point-blank range from which it was fired. I'm Craig Windham, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's been said that very few people listened to the Velvet Underground during the years the band was together, but everyone who did listen started their own band. The Velvet Underground never made the charts, but today they're recognized as one of the most important bands in rock history. Now, 25 years after the band broke up, there's a new CD box set that collects their recordings from 1965 to 1970. Rock historian Ed Ward has the first of a 2-part review. Then we'll hear from actress Mary Woronoff, who toured with the Velvets doing the whip dance.
$6 in my hand. Up to Lexington, 125. Feel sick and dirty, more dead than alive. I'm waiting for the man.
Things didn't look good for American rock and roll in 1965. The Brits were running riot over our charts, and while Retaliation was in the works, it seemed like it would be a long time before we came up with anything half as innovative or important as the Beatles or the Rolling Stones were doing. Actually, though, something did happen, something that was ignored at the time, the Velvet Underground. The Velvet Underground was the result of a unique group of talents getting together. Lewis Allen Reed, a troubled Long Island teenager who'd recorded while still in high school and then attended Syracuse University to study literature. Sterling Morrison, who was attending classes there, but never registered, and John Cale, who met Reed while they were both working at a schlock rock label, recording Hot Rod novelty records in the year after Reed's graduation. Reed and Morrison had the literary background, Cale the avant-garde musical chops. He'd come from his native Wales on a Leonard Bernstein scholarship and was performing with Lamont Young, father of today's avant-garde, and hacking out rock novelties to pay the bills. The three started jamming at Cale's downtown New York loft, and the results sounded like Simon and Garfunkel, until the lyrics kicked in.
Shiny, shiny boots of leather, whiplash girl child in the dark, comes in bells your servant, don't forsake him. Strike, dear mistress, cure his heart.
They added Maureen Tucker, sister of Morrison's college roommate, on drums after their first drummer proved too weird and started calling themselves the Velvet Underground after a book on suburban sadomasochism they'd found in the street. Journalist Al Aronowitz got them a steady gig at Café Bazaar. They were fired before too long, but not before attracting the attention of Andy Warhol, who needed a band for a multimedia spectacular he was planning. And early in 1966, he produced their first album. Those songs from Cale's loft were transformed.
Shiny, shiny, shiny boots of leather, whiplash girl child in the dark, comes in bells, your servant, don't forsake him. Strike, dear mistress, and cure his heart.
Cale's electric viola, the droning guitars, not to mention the subject matter, this was something new. But Warhol insisted that the four weren't glamorous enough, and he added a singer, Christa Päfgen, a German model who'd been doing some recording in London and used the name Nico. She added another dimension to the sound. Her vocal range was identical to Reed's, and yes, she was glamorous, in a chilly sort of way. Having Warhol's art cachet freed the band to experiment sonically, too, and here Cale's genius kicked in. The notorious noise blowout, starting with an electrified metal chair being scraped across the floor in European Sun, was definitely aimed at the New York art crowd. They'd released their first album while they were still riding high on their success in Warhol's Plastic Exploding Inevitable show, they might have achieved some notoriety, but things dragged on and it didn't appear until early 1967, at which point Peace and Love didn't want to know about those boots of shiny, shiny leather. Undaunted, the band went back into the studio in September to make a second record, without Nico, and with their avant-garde tendencies in full cry. White Light, White Heat was a truly inspired failure. Some of it was virtually unlistenable more than once, like Cale's reading an undergraduate short story of Reed's on The Gift. And then there was Sister Ray, 17 minutes of ghastly noise that sort of grew on you if you could stay the course. Distorted almost to the point of pain, with perverse lyrics, this music opposed nearly everything the new era seemed to stand for. The album vanished almost without a trace. Warhol was out of the picture, and tension between Cale and Reed was reaching a high point. Who would have thought they stood on the verge of making one of the greatest albums of all time?
Ed Ward is a writer living in Berlin. He reviewed the new Velvet Underground box set. We'll hear part two of his review tomorrow. Actress Mary Woronoff dropped out of college in the mid-60s to dance and tour with the Velvet Underground and to appear in the Andy Warhol movie Chelsea Girls. She's written a memoir about that period of her life called Swimming Underground, My Years in the Warhol Factory. Woronoff went on to act in several Roger Corman films, including Death Race 2000 and Hollywood Boulevard. She also co-starred in the film comedies Eating Raoul and Scenes from the Class Struggle in Beverly Hills. I asked her what her life was like before she became part of the Warhol crowd.
My life was at Cornell University, and before that it was a very 50s home life. I went to a private girls' school, and my mother was a housewife, and my father was a doctor, and everything was very Ozzie and Harriet, you know, very happy, but not very happy. When I got to Cornell, my life changed. Radically. Suddenly, sex was around, and there were other people who took drugs. And very shortly into Cornell, I met Gerard, and I went into the Warhol factory.
This is Gerard Malanga.
Yes.
And he was the one who introduced you to Warhol and the people
came
around him. Yeah, how did you meet Malanga?
Well, at Cornell, I hung out with a very druggy crowd. They liked rock and roll, and they liked drugs, and they were, it was sort of like they considered themselves the inheritors of the beat generation, so they, did poetry and things like that. And Gerard was a poet, and he knew most of the people who were poets at most of the universities. Gerard was a very well-connected person. And he came to see a friend of mine whose name was David Murray. And that's how I met him. David introduced me to Gerard, and then he started coming up to Cornell. And, well, one time he came up and he brought a camera and he wanted to make a film of me. And I have to tell you that when I first saw him, you know, he was totally dressed in black leather. He was carrying a whip. I mean, he had this, like, gorgeous blonde hair and necklaces on his neck. He was very unlike what I was accustomed to, you know, the regular Levi denim boy, you know, sort of slouched with a lot of pimples.
So you ran into him at the Warhol studio in New York, kind of on a class trip, visiting artist studios.
Well, that was another thing. Cornell organized a class where we went to New York and we visited other artist studio. And what happened is we went to Warhol studio. And Warhol studio was totally unlike anybody else's studio. The other studios were sort of like white boxes with lots of light and paintings on the walls. At Warhol, there were no paintings on the walls. The walls were covered with tinfoil, and it was dark, and it was weird. And there was stuff all over the place. It was messy. It was very evil-looking and chaotic-looking. And there were always people hanging around, obviously people who weren't, you know, artists. I mean, they had nothing to do with art. They were just good-looking and hanging around and very moody-looking. And I don't know, I was attracted.
So you became a dancer with the Warhol show, The Exploding Plastic Inevitable. And you and Gerald Malanga used to dance to the Velvet Underground's performances.
Yes, that was, well, actually what happened is, the first thing that happened is I did a movie. And then I thought, well, this is fine. I have a job, you know, I'm going to do these movies for Warhol, for which I'm not paid. What a great job. I was very naive. And then added to what happened is the Barbara Rubin brought the Velvets in and they would play. And you know, Gerard was not one to give up a stage, so he would get up on the stage and start dancing, and I was with him, so I would get up on the stage and start dancing too. And it just became this, like, show. They put a movie in back of the Velvets, and we danced in front, and the Velvets played, and then Andy started moving it around as the Exploding Plastic Inevitable, and we went to California. But, yeah, I danced in front of them all the time. It was great. And we had these... Oh, I'm sorry.
I want you to describe the dances that you and Malanga did to the Velvets.
That's going to sound very strange, but, well, first of all, both of us are dressed in black leather by now, and both of us have, you know, whips. But it was definitely rock and roll dancing. It wasn't, you know, Martha Graham-ish at all. It was rock and roll, but we would have all these different things like black lights and like those flickering strobe lights and crosses, and we would dance with these objects. Everybody there was very accustomed to happenings, as they were called then. You call them performances now. But doing things while you were dancing was nothing. I mean, it was considered fine. And Gerard and I were just very good together. We were very instinctive. So, you know, you dance, both of you have a whip, you know, you do all of these sort of, you know, pretend S&M things while you're dancing.
Like what?
Oh, he spent a lot of time on his knees, and he kissed the whip. Because, you know, in one of the songs it says, kiss the whip lightly. He would do that. And, you know, we would just, it was actually very sexy what we did.
That song also says something about licking your shiny boots. Did he lick your boots too?
A lot of kissing of boots and licking of boots. As a matter of fact, he made a whole movie of it. I didn't get to talk in that movie, obviously, but look, we were very young and we just did things, you know, and nobody said no.
What was your favorite song to dance to?
My favorite song to dance to was Venus in Furs.
Kiss the boot of shiny, shiny leather. Shiny leather in the dark. Tongue the thongs, the belt that does await you. Strike, dear mistress, and cure his heart. Severin, speak so slightly. Severin, down on your bended knee. Taste the whip, in love not given lightly. Taste the whip, now bleed for me.
I guess it's Mary Woronoff, and she's written a new memoir called Swimming Underground, My Years in the Warhol Factory. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with actress Mary Woronoff, author of the new memoir, Swimming Underground, My Years in the Warhol Factory. Well, the plastic exploding inevitable, the Warhol Roadshow, went to California, and it was a disaster there.
Yes.
What happened? Nobody came?
No. Well, there was one night where several people came, like Cher, and they all thumbed their noses at us. And then nobody came, and then they shut down the club that we were at, which was called The Trip. The reason why is because there was tremendous antagonism between New York and L.A. L.A. was, you know, full of color, full of acid, full of hippies, and we were not like that. We dressed in black and white. We did not like free love. We liked S&M and real restraint, perversion too. We took amphetamine. They took LSD. They were, you know, sort of loving and happy, and we weren't really evil. We were more intellectual, more about art.
Most of the people in the Warhol crowd had a persona, you know, often a pose of some sort, or a transformed person who they became. Did you have a pose, a persona?
Yes.
What was it?
My pose at the time was unsexual, gender shifting into male, very powerful, very threatening.
Now, you describe yourself as asexual in your persona, yet the whip dance that you did was very much about sexual turn-on. So make those two add up for me.
I believe that, especially during Warhol, one of the sexiest things about that whole time was gender slipping. I do not think that it's unsexy. I think it's very sexy. A girl... Well, first of all, I mean, the entire basis of Warhol's movies in the beginning was all of the drag queens, and they certainly were gender slippage, and they were certainly very, very sexy. A lot of art is about, you know, gender slippage, and that's what makes it sexy. That's what makes it interesting and attractive.
But you described yourself as having an asexual pose, and yet...
I did not come on flirty, you know, and want a lot of guys. I would pretend that I was a man. Not pretend that I was a man. I would act very masculine. And to see such pretty girl act very masculine was a turn-on. I mean, all I did was act, you know, sort of tough.
And you're about 6 feet tall, so you were imposing also.
Yes. Everybody posed. If you didn't pose, nobody saw you. It was a fight to get the biggest pose on. And that's what we liked, posing. I mean, you can't be around all of those queens and not think about posing every minute of the day. It was a language.
Was it tiring after a while to live in a pose? Or did you become that person?
Nothing was tiring. We were all on amphetamine. There was no tired.
But was it mentally exhausting to have to stay in a pose all the time? Or did you become the person?
No, you never become the person. I mean, the whole thing about our poses were they were completely ridiculous. I mean, I mean, first of all, half of those guys, you know, they when they got dressed up as girls, they didn't do it like guys do it now. It was you know, totally dumb. They'd have runs in their stockings and, you know, runs in their hair. And it was about doing something that was not, obviously not working, but pretending it is working to such an extent that everybody buys it. It was fun.
I think the thing that I found alarming reading your memoir was a time when you and a lot of the Warhol people were, I guess it was a, you know, a party or a gathering of some sort, and one of the women there OD'd.
Yes.
And someone stretched her out on the table, and the party kind of continued.
Yes.
She was kind of like the centerpiece at the table.
We were so far gone that death didn't really enter in as this is a person and her life is gone. We weren't even thinking of her as a person.
She actually lived. She hadn't really died.
No, she hadn't. She hadn't. I mean, I didn't have that much experience with heroin, and apparently you look like you can go under and then you come back. And I didn't even know she was shot with heroin. So, we all thought she was dead.
At what point did you say to yourself, it is not human to behave this way? You know, that something's terribly wrong.
Yeah. When I stopped taking drugs.
I mean, were you shocked when you looked back on that?
No, because I can remember how I felt. It was fine. And I didn't really get in trouble. I mean, you know, a lot of people get in trouble with drugs and they see people, you know, shot in the head and killed. And I, you know, really, I was very, very protected.
Right.
But this was, the reason why this is in the book is because this was like, a slight error. You know, and I understand it was just really horrible, and thank God she did live, but it was like, oh, a slight error. I mean, you know.
That's how far gone you all were.
Yeah. Yeah, we were really crazed on that one.
Mary Woronoff has written a new memoir called Swimming Underground, My Years in the Warhol Factory. She'll be back with us in the second part of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Mary Woronoff about life in Andy Warhol's factory. Then, reviewing the entertainment values and moral values of movies, we talk with the director of the Catholic Church's new movie review hotline.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with the second part of our interview with actress Mary Woronoff. She's written a new memoir called Swimming Underground about the mid-60s when she was part of the Andy Warhol factory. She was in his film Chelsea Girls and toured with the Velvet Underground doing the whip dance in Warhol's show The Exploding Plastic Inevitable. She's since appeared in several Roger Corman films and in the satires Eating Raoul and Scenes from the Class Struggle in Beverly Hills. I don't know if you saw this or not, but Victor Boukris, while writing about the life and death of Andy Warhol, quoted Gerard Malanga as saying, "Mary was someone I invented. I got a whip in her hand, spread her name around, made her a star, but she did not show any interest, and because of her passiveness, allowed herself to be eclipsed by Ingrid's superstar." What do you make of that?
Gerard is right. He definitely invented me. He found me at Cornell, and when he brought me to New York, I was definitely someone different. But I wanted that invention. I really loved that whole scene. I mean, he would suggest something, and I would go, yes. The reason why he says that I was passive and eclipsed is I was not interested in becoming a superstar. I was not interested in fighting for Edie Sedgwick's place. Fine, I would do a movie, but I was not interested in becoming a star. They loved girls to fight and, you know, to try and be stars, and I just would not take that place. If Ingrid wanted to pretend she was a star, fine, go let her. I refused to go into that game, and Gerard was furious with me because, rightfully so, I was the most talented. I was the one who, you know, understood what should be happening. Even Andy said this to me. But I just, you know, I didn't feel like fighting. I like the queens. I like the whole drug scene. I just wanted to do what I wanted to do. I didn't, you know, if Andy sat down and then four girls tried to sit next to him, I'd walk the other way.
Now, you write in your book that this was a period when you didn't like sex.
No, I hated it.
I'm trying to figure out if I can ask you to explain why on the radio. What do you think?
Well, for one thing, my parents didn't get along the way I thought someone should get along, so I definitely was against marriage. I was also, at the time, very young, and I was furious at the thought that I should be happy just being a wife with a man. That really infuriated me. I had floating rage about that one. The other thing is that I went to Cornell after being, you know, a virgin for a very long time. I did not have a great experience. I mean, you know, this apparently very nice kid, tried to go with me. And I was just so mad and so angry that it didn't work out. And instead of being upset, I said, okay, we're just going to make rules. And one of the rules is that, you know, sex just isn't in the game for me, and I just don't want it. And, you know, these other girls can, you know, go make fools of themselves, but for me, it's out. And I would do that, and then I would say, this is the way I'm going to lead my life. And until I met a giant stone wall, that's the way I did lead my life. I would always make up rules and say, this is the way it's going to be, and I'm going to do this, and I'm going to be different than everybody else.
I do find it really interesting that during this period when you were defiant about not having sex, that you were doing this very provocative whip dance, turning yourself on and everybody else.
No, I think it's really normal because you can't shut someone down when they're starting to peak with their hormones. I mean, I had to do something.
So it all came out in the dance.
Yes, it all came out in everything I did, everything I touched. I mean, I was a walking joke. You can't just shut someone. I was a, you know, a fool, a young fool.
Tell us who Undine was.
Undine? Undine was probably one of those, you meet one or two great people in your life, and he was one. He was homosexual. He wasn't really a queen because although he was very, very good looking, he felt he was too masculine to get, you know, dressed up in drag or anything like that. But he was someone who, I don't know, you know, he could like keep opposites in his head. Where I went into the Warhol thing saying, this is black and this is white and I'm going to do this and that's not going to happen. He was not that kind of person. He was exactly the opposite. He could understand how someone could be good and bad. And he would not forgive them, but love them for it. Like if he said, isn't that just horrible, darling? It was always said like, isn't that wonderful, darling? At a time when I was very hard on myself and very hard on everybody around me, like, you know, I didn't want pity. I didn't want this. This man was so full of feelings. He was totally unafraid of feelings. He could like something a lot. He could even love something. I had tremendous difficulty with loving anything. My world was loveless. It was filled with rage, and he understood the rage, but he could also, I mean, that's what I mean by opposites, along with the rage. And he definitely, let me tell you, when he was angry, the room cleared. This man was very, very fierce. But he never would have just rage without all of the love to go with it. He was amazing.
What was your anger from, do you know?
Mine?
Mm-hmm.
My anger was from not having the world as I wanted it, that's all. My mom, didn't act the way I wanted. I wasn't pleased about dying at the end of my life. I wanted to control everything, and I was learning that, you know, you get to control nothing, and it really pissed me off.
My guest is Mary Woronoff. She's written a new memoir called Swimming Underground, My Years in the Warhol Factory. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with actress Mary Woronoff. She's written a new memoir about her years with Andy Warhol and the Velvet Underground. Now, you were in Warhol's film Chelsea Girls. Why don't you describe your role in that?
My role in Chelsea Girls was, first of all, the name was Hanoi Hannah, and it was taken from this woman who had a radio show during the war, and she would taunt the American GIs. But rather than being sexy about it, I think I was just basically brutal. Brutal beyond what a normal girl should be capable of. Also intelligent, so that I sort of knew what was going on. What Warhol would do is he would put a lot of people, you know, in front of a camera and then hope that something would happen. I knew what he sort of wanted to happen, and I would engineer it. And then, you know, people would fall into place. You know, if you had one strong person, you needed a victim. And so the victim would usually be found. And then, you know, you do what you can.
Your mother sued Andy Warhol after Chelsea Girls. Why? Because he didn't pay you? Was that it?
No, he didn't pay anybody. He was like Corman. He was the cheapest man in the world. My mother thought that... My mother always stood behind me. She said I was doing something artistic. I went to Cornell to be an artist. Now I was with Warhol. It did not matter to her that, you know, I was running around in skin-tight leather paraphernalia and drugged out of my mind. It was artistic. So she let me do all of these things. But the minute that I stopped showing interest, she suggested to me that I should get paid. And then... Morrissey came to me and he said he wanted me to sign something.
This is Paul Morrissey who made some of the films.
Yes. He said he wanted me to sign a release for Chelsea Girls. And I told my mother, she had always told me never to sign anything because she was afraid I was going to sign something communist, you know. So I told my mom and she said, no, don't sign that and let me sue him. And I just, you know, I said, okay. So she sued him.
What came
out
of it?
She got $1,000 and she got his undying hatred. That's what came out of it. He hated it. He hated giving out money, especially in that manner. Of course, I'd hate that too. And that's when I started leaving the factory.
Were you embarrassed that your mother was suing on your behalf, or did you support her in the suit?
My mother is a very special person. I was used to her, you know, throwing a fit in a restaurant. This certainly didn't embarrass me. My mother could never be controlled.
So you started leaving the factory after this lawsuit?
Warhol definitely got cool towards me after the lawsuit, and I was not asked to do movies anymore. I noticed that when I hung around the set of the 24-hour movie, I wasn't really asked to be in. I mean, the people would ask me, but Warhol wasn't behind it that much, and so I left. Started doing plays for Ronnie Tavel.
You know, it's interesting to me that during this whole period when you were part of the Warhol crowd and, you know, you were performing with the Velvet Underground, your home was with your parents. You were still living with your—you weren't there every night, maybe, but that was still your home.
That was my home, yes.
So, you know, you'd go from this incredibly out there kind of scene back to your parents' middle class nice home.
Yes, and lucky for me I did, otherwise I'd be dead. In other words, when you get high, you have to come down. When you go out, you have to come home. I had no money. I had to stay there.
Do you think this is part of the reason why you survived when so many of the Warhol people were casualties?
Absolutely. You can't get high without coming down. That's a myth.
So you really think you have your parents to thank in a way?
Oh, of course. My parents were great to me.
Do you think your mother did the right thing in not objecting to your behavior during that period?
Absolutely. If she had objected, first of all, you can't object. A child has to go through, and not just a child, everybody has to go through, it's like a journey that you take so that you can become, you know, someone else, so you can get, you know, your third eye or whatever. You can, you know, like, that's the American way, to go through something, a cathartic thing, so that in the end you gain stuff. And any kid knows that. They know they have to prove themselves. They, you know, they have to, I mean, kids used to want to go to war or whatever. Well, this was my war. Now, I met up with a stone wall because I went in with, you know, like, not a bad attitude, but just the wrong idea. I had to go through it again. But if she had stopped me, if she had stopped me and not let me do what I had to do, I would have gone harder, much harder.
Mm-hmm.
I would have left home, and that wouldn't be good.
What did you do with your life after leaving Warhol?
Well, for about a half a year, I just sat down and recovered.
Mm-hmm.
I had a tremendous addiction to get rid of.
And you got rid of it that quickly?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, in my family, you know, you just... my family is really strange. But, you know, you don't say anything. And the first thing I did was get very fat. And I just sat in my bedroom till that went away. It took about a couple of months. And then slowly but surely, I started being, you know, the next person. And went on a date. All the way to Europe. And, you know, you start again. But my parents, my parents are the 50s. You know, they never mention that you've done something wrong. When I came back and sat in my bedroom, you know, for about 2 months, they treated it as if, you know, everything was fine, which was, thank God, because I couldn't explain what was going on. All I know is I needed to rest.
Do you know who you are now, and are you comfortable with that person?
I am more comfortable with myself because I have gone through a lot of things. And, you know, once you go through these things, you go, yeah, well, you know, life isn't that bad. I still ask people what they think of me or who I am to them. So I don't know everything, no. And I do finally feel fulfilled because of this book. I know that I'm a good writer, and I'm really, really proud of myself for the first time.
Mary Warrenoff is the author of the new memoir, Swimming Underground, My Years in the Warhol Factory. She also has a recent book of her paintings and stories called Wake for the Angels. This is Fresh Air. The Catholic Church has a new movie review hotline. It rates new movies and video releases according to entertainment values and moral values. The ratings range from general patronage to morally offensive. The reviews, which are a project of the Catholic Communication Campaign, come out of the U.S. Catholic Conference Office for Film and Broadcasting. My guest, Henry Herks, directs the office and writes many of the reviews. He's been reviewing movies for the church since 1962, when he was the founding director of the Chicago Archdiocese Center for Film Study, which was later affiliated with the National Legion of Decency. In those days, Catholics were asked to pledge they would refrain from seeing movies deemed morally offensive. The new Catholic Movie Hotline can be reached at 1-800-311-4CCC. We gave it a call to check out the review of Casino.
Because of much graphic violence, adulterous affairs, fleeting nudity, substance abuse, and incessant rough language, the U.S. Catholic Conference classification is O, morally offensive. The Motion Picture Association of America rating is R, restricted. Casino is an increasingly violent movie about the rise and fall of a mob-backed Las Vegas casino manager, played by Robert De Niro, who is married to a money-obsessed drug addict, played by Sharon Stone, and the murderous gangster she seduces in hopes he will kill the husband she despises. Director Martin Scorsese spins a well-acted, compelling yarn that is ultimately ruined by an excess of sadistic violence.
Henry Herks, you have rated Casino O, which means rated morally offensive. What does that rating actually signify?
This is an indication that we feel the particular motion picture exploits people. It exploits sexuality or violence. And our advice is this is not something that you would wish to see.
Now, you gave the story morally offensive. The Motion Picture Association of America gives Casino an R for restricted. What's the difference between your approach to rating and their approach to rating?
Well, the Motion Picture Association is rating its movies based upon individual scenes which they feel a parent would not want their children to see. We are looking more at the context of a movie, at how a movie treats its subject and how successfully it does that. Consequently, there is a broad relationship between our ratings and the MPAA ratings. However, when you get into an R rating, you are dealing with something the MPAA does not deal with, which is how successful the film is in terms of dealing with its moral complexities.
Why are you rating the moral values as well as the entertainment values of movies?
Well, because that's part of the significance or meaning of any work of popular culture. It does have some moral integrity. It has some moral message that it is sending. And we're just as interested in that as we are in terms of its filmmaking skills.
Now, when you give a movie like Casino an O for morally offensive, does that mean that you're telling Catholics not to see it, that you're recommending to Catholics that they don't see it?
We're giving them some basis for them to make a judgment about whether they want to see it.
Mm-hmm. So this isn't like a forbidden list or anything like that?
No, it's a list of consumer information, helping people make up their own mind whether they wish to see a particular film. But it's especially addressed to parents with information which we think is helpful for them to decide what is suitable for their family.
By the way, is there any Martin Scorsese films you'd recommend?
Well, Mean Streets, one of his very first films, is an extremely, knowledgeable film about a particular culture in New York City. And it does create characters who come to life and who are trying to make it in their own particular world.
And the movie is very much about faith. The opening scene,
that's right, yeah,
is in a church.
Right. It is in an Italian Catholic culture, and it portrays there quite well, although it is quite violent.
But that doesn't bother you in the context of that film?
No, I don't. I think that particular example is a film that does work.
Mm-hmm. Let me play another review from your telephone review hotline, and this is a review of Wild Bill, a new film about Wild Bill Hickok.
Because of much stylized violence, a constrained sex scene, sexual innuendo, and coarse language, The U.S. Catholic Conference classification is A4, adults with reservation. The Motion Picture Association of America rating is R, restricted. Wild Bill is a muddled Western with Jeff Bridges in the role of Wild Bill Hickok, the feared gunfighter who's confronted in 1876 by an inept youth determined to kill him for mistreating his mother. The movie whizzes through Hickok's early exploits, then bogs down in a prolonged series of bizarre events, including opium dreams and strange memories, before the final shootout.
That review is from the 800 Movie Review Line, run by the United States Catholic Conference Office for Film and Broadcasting Movie Classifications. My guest, Henry Herks, directs the office. You've rated Wild Bill adults with reservations. And in your classification descriptions, you say, adults with reservations means these films are not for casual entertainment and require some caution. Though not morally offensive in themselves, such movies are of a problematic nature, requiring some analysis and explanation to avoid misinterpretation and false conclusions. Would you explain what your concern is there, the need for interpretation so that we don't go to misinterpretation and false conclusions?
Yeah, that verbiage is simply to say that not all adults will find this film morally uplifting or rewarding. It is simply a realization and understanding that various people see various things in particular movies, depending upon their background and experience with the film medium. So it's a way of indicating that this film may not be suitable for a particular individual, but that others might find it quite interesting and, in fact, morally acceptable.
How are you rating Toy Story? What does that get?
It's A1.
And that translates to general patronage.
Right.
So you like the film?
The film is a kind of tour de force of computer animation. I think it is somewhat slim in terms of its storyline. These toys take on a human persona, but the kind of difficulties that they have to overcome are what I don't think are classic examples of something that children will find enjoyable for generation after generation.
Do the films that you found morally offensive in the 60s seem really tame by comparison now? Maybe you could take an example of a film that was rated O for morally offensive in the early 60s and talk about it now and tell us if you'd see it as being good by comparison.
Well, something like give you an example of the difficulty involved in terms of one rating system in a particular era and another in another era. There isn't any simple correlation there. One has to understand the reason why these films were deemed morally offensive in the 50s and 60s. One example that I use is something like Miracle on 34th Street, that in 1947, I believe was the year, that film was rated morally offensive in part by the Legion of Decency because the central character was a divorced woman who was planning on remarrying. Because of video making all these older films available, we've been re-rating some of those older films. And so Miracle on 34th Street was given the A2 rating when it came on video.
And A2 is adults and adolescents.
Yes, right.
Such movies contain elements that children may find confusing, but that most teenagers can understand without the need for parental guidance.
Mm-hmm.
Probably most kids understand divorce now, too. So many kids' parents are divorced.
Well, yeah, it's become a prevalent part of our society.
If a film is about a gay or lesbian person, will that affect the rating that you give the film?
Well, once again, it's how it is treated in the film.
Well, say it's not punished. Say it's accepted.
But once again, it's whether it's treating that relationship in a real way, which means that this is something that is not normal. It is painful. It is troubling. It is difficult. that it is not something that is being advocated or promoted. And an example would be Jeffrey, which came out about 4 months ago,
mm-hmm.
which is about homosexuals and the fear of AIDS, and which promotes homosexual activity. And this is one which we gave the O to. Philadelphia, which was made the end of 93, I believe, was one which deals with a young man's contracting AIDS and his rejection by society. And we felt that this was one that dealt with the subject in a very responsible way, making the viewer aware of the problems and difficulties of a homosexual.
Do you hope that your movie review line will have any impact on the film industry?
The only thing that will have impact on the film industry is the box office returns. In a modest way, I hope we might help people identify those films that would be best to support by going to the movie theater.
Henry Herks directs the U.S. Catholic Conference Office for Film and Broadcasting. Their movie review line can be reached at 1-800-311-4CCC. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our program was produced today by Fred Landerl. Technical direction from Audrey Bentham. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Crown, publisher of Ken Follett's new novel, A Place Called Freedom. Celebrating 25 years of radio excellence, this is NPR, National Public Radio.